Let me ask you a question. What did you think when you heard this?
Donald Trump has survived what the FBI described as an assassination attempt at a campaign.
Was it horror at an attempted assassination? Or did you think, as some people mused, if only that bullet had hit a few inches to the right?
The attacker who fired shots from a
And what about this?
The Labour MP, Jo Cox, has been killed outside the library where she was holding her constituency
surgery. Was it again horror?
Leading to the suspension of campaigning.
If you felt something else or differently about the two, then this programme is both for you and about you. Because how we respond to political violence is crucial. If we condone it or look like we do, the sense that committing political violence is unacceptable begins to shift. And when that happens, the likelihood of actual violence increases. I'm Alison Goldsworthy. I'm a recovering political activist, co-author of a book about polarisation, Poles Apart, and leadership lecturer at Stanford University. I spent my life trying to figure out how to bring people together in uncertain times. In this programme, I'm asking what that means in terms of political violence in established democracies. Because 10 years after the murder of Jo Cox MP, political violence is still on the rise. MPs are, rightly, really concerned.
Each time I enter this chamber, my eyes are drawn to the shields dedicated to Jo Cox and to Sir David Amis. They are not simply memorials. They are a daily reminder of the duty we owe to one another and to our democracy to ensure that...
I'll be investigating what causes people in an established democracy to condone and thereby normalise political violence. Violence committed with the aim of challenging, attaining or retaining political power. The definition I'll be using. The uncomfortable truth, and the reason I started by asking you that question about Donald Trump and Jo Cox, is that all the research suggests justifying political violence isn't just something other people do. We're all susceptible. But let's begin with a story about respectful discourse across profound divides.
The whole point of the Oxford Union is about being able to talk to people and have a conversation if you disagree with them. And, you know, you don't have to win every conversation, you just have to learn something from the conversation.
This is Oxford Uni undergraduate George Abercrombie. In early 2025, he was part of the group deciding if the right-wing American political activist and close Trump ally, Charlie Kirk, should be invited to the university's venerable debating society, the Oxford Union.
There was, I think, significant debate, actually, before Charlie Kirk even came, as to whether or not we should be kind of inviting someone like Charlie Kirk, you know, the moniker, we don't debate fascists. But I was kind of the opinion that someone like Charlie Kirk has a big enough platform that he is someone that I think should be challenged because he doesn't exist in a vacuum and commentators like him don't exist in a vacuum.
Kirk, a conservative provocateur known for racially and politically incendiary remarks, had gathered a big following by going onto college campuses. His tours were designed to provoke, but they were underpinned by a commitment that overlapped with the unions. A forum for colliding ideas and discussions.
So please welcome me introducing Charlie Kirk.
I was in the buildings that day. I had been doing some work and, you know, as someone who's interested in kind of debate culture and just dialectic and discourse in general, I thought, well, why not go and at least watch and see what happens?
Welcome.
Thank you. Honored to be here.
George hadn't originally planned to speak in the debate.
He talked about masculinity, he talked about DEI and some crime rates amongst black communities, various different issues. And throughout the whole thing, I just felt myself be more and more worked up, agitated.
As he got more worked up, George decided to take part.
Are there like any other reasons as to why this generation of lost boys might exist, or do you basically attribute
yes,
it to
I just... acknowledge all of that, of course. I mean, one of them, it's a very good faith question, and thank you.
The warm feeling was reciprocated.
He was a particularly polite person, very respectful, which almost was an interesting dissonance between that and then some of his political opinions. I enjoyed the challenge. I enjoyed, you know, having my view stretched and being able to work around it and explain that and fully engage with the points I was trying to make.
When the debate was over, Kirk returned to America to continue touring universities. And just a few weeks later, at least in part because of his clash with Kirk, George won the election to become the next president of the Oxford Union.
A close ally of Donald Trump, the leading conservative activist Charlie Kirk, has been shot dead at an event on a university.
Then, on the 10th of September, while speaking at a university in Utah, Charlie Kirk was shot. And George, who months earlier had engaged in a debate with him so successfully it had gained him plaudits and status, impulsively took to social media with a starkly different tone. Charlie Kirk got shot. Lol, George wrote on Instagram. Charlie Kirk got shot. Let's effing go, he sent to a WhatsApp group. What had happened? What made this adroit brain that was so committed to dialogue switch to condoning, even celebrating, violence? To answer that, we need to go back to the Second World War, when research in the field really began. A debate opened up as to whether our behaviour is driven by our personalities or the environment.
It felt urgent to so many social psychologists to understand, why is it that people can so easily fall into a totalitarian ideology? What makes a person a potential fascist?
This is Dr. Lior's Migrod. She's a political neuroscientist and author of The Ideological Brain.
One of the forgotten thinkers in social psychology is called Elsa Frankel Brunswick, and she escaped Nazi Vienna in 1938 and managed to relocate to Berkeley, where she started to ask what kinds of traits might make children predisposed to authoritarian regimes. They invited thousands of children in California and looked at their prejudice.
Frankel Brunswick's research, at the same time deeply insightful and with a blind spot, profoundly shaped thinking for decades after.
They were very much obsessed with the idea that because of their historical context, the characteristics that might make a person authoritarian would only be seen on the right. And so they started to create this hypothesis, which was that perhaps people who tend towards right-wing authoritarianisms would be more cognitively rigid thinkers, that they would tend to see the world in more binary black and white ways, that they would struggle to adapt to nuance and shades of grey.
Shortly after, a second school of thought evolved.
I'm Bill Swan. I'm an emeritus at University of Texas. I'm currently affiliated with the University of Oregon as well. The social identity theory argued that, no, it's really about the situation, that if you have a trigger in the situation, that will cause you to discriminate. So it really turned the authoritarian idea on its head by saying that it's not personality, it's the situation.
These researchers conducted experiments to show what kind of situations could induce people to discriminate in favour of people like them and against those who were not. In some infamous trials, participants even embraced violence.
One of the classic studies in social psychology involved what's called the minimal group paradigm. What they found in that study was that even if the source of the group alignment is completely arbitrary, so it can be a coin toss, you'll be more likely to discriminate against members of an outgroup, and it can be applied to any kind of group, political, social, race, whatever.
So two schools of thought. One suggested the roots of seeing the other as the enemy was personality driven. The other, that it could be triggered by the environment. We'll hear later how that connects so directly to political violence. But for now, let's pick up with George and Charlie Kirk's shooting.
I was at home at the time. I was watching TV. I was watching Arrested Development. And I saw kind of a notification on Twitter about the shooting. And at the time, there was, I think, very little information about it. Truthfully, I just reacted. I couldn't give you a very coherent or logical explanation as to why I reacted in the way I did. But I kind of just reacted in the moment in a way that I have very much come to regret. There was nothing that I think I needed to say at that moment. I posted some things on my social media. I said some things in a group chat. At the time, very kind of divisive and probably inappropriate for the moment.
Very quickly, though, it became clear how seriously Kirk had been hurt. He later died of his injuries.
In that moment, the severity of the situation dawned on me a little bit, at which point I kind of deleted everything, tried to course correct and apologise and post a bit more of a well-considered and well-thought-out kind of statement, I guess, or I don't know, just something to say regarding the situation and the political climate. A couple hours later, went to bed.
But the damage had been done.
So it was kind of a big shock when I woke up the next morning to kind of a write a reply from, I want to say it was the Daily Mail, regarding, you know, screenshots of what I'd said and them about to write a story about it.
Rapidly, George's life was upended. Despite trying to walk back his statement, influential politicians, journalists and alumni from around the world weighed in. He was removed as president-elect. I asked him about the messages he received.
Well, I have my phone with me. I can look if you give me a moment.
Are you okay looking?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hopefully it'll load a bit. A lot of people talking about DEI, that I was an evil human being, that, you know, Charlie Kirk was a much better person than I was. A lot of people saying, you know, oh, we're going to turn up at your university, or we're going to find you in London, or that you should watch your back. You've got something coming for you and you'll be deserving of whatever happens to you. There was the journalist who had remarked that if someone shot me, it would be worth the 50 years in prison.
Yes, that's right. As people castigated George for celebrating an act of political violence, some of them responded by calling for another act of political violence, his murder. After taking several months to begin processing, George reappeared in public to apologise.
I also did want to say sorry. So in a lot of my considerations and talking to my friends, a lot of them had told me, you shouldn't have to say sorry. And originally, I was very hesitant to say sorry because, well, firstly, I don't like admitting when I'm wrong. But also because in the moment, I wasn't sure that I was sorry. I didn't want to say something I didn't believe in. Upon reflection, I was sorry. I think I was sorry because I kind of recognised who I was within this discourse, in that I am probably the only person in the world who was the president-elect of a debating chamber, a debating house, a black person, and also someone who has met and debated Charlie Kirk. That is a very specific kind of triangle of circumstance. And I, perhaps more than anyone, bore a responsibility to react in a way that was not so inflammatory or was more measured or considered. I represent a debating chamber, and as a representation of the debating chamber, I have to uphold ideas around free speech and open debate. I am a black person, and so I need to be considerate of, well, how I'm going to be perceived when I make commentary and when I say certain things. And that's just a hard truth of the world. And I'm also someone that's met Charlie Kirk. And so there is a level of expected empathy that comes with having met someone and having experienced that person and then seeing them pass on. And so I apologised because I felt that I had missed a mark.
Which leads us to a further piece of this puzzle, one whose power academics are still grappling to understand. How individual identity, in the way that George talked about his race, sex and commitment to free speech, merges with group identity, and how they may be triggered by the environment. A quarter of a century ago, it was Bill Swan, the University of Texas professor, who began putting this together.
In 2003, 2004, I started interacting with a guy named Angel Gomez in Madrid.
Madrid's train station is quite close to my house. It's, I don't know, 20 minutes walking. And I was involved during the day of the attacks.
There's been a series of explosions on commuter trains at stations in Madrid, killing at least 60 people.
I was working as a volunteer, trying to attend the victims and the families. And I was trying to help after the attack in some way as a psychologist. But the response were that I am not a clinical psychologist. I am a social psychologist. And I told them, I want to help.
So Angel, a professor at the National University of Learning and Education in Spain, had his offer of help declined after the Madrid bombings because his expertise wasn't in treating individuals. But he and Bill saw how their expertise could be useful in understanding group behaviour.
And that was just after the Twin Towers went down. And so we became intrigued with the idea of explaining this behavior of the terrorists. And so we became interested in the idea that their beliefs about themselves were fused with this belief about an identity about the group. And so we started doing a series of studies where we devised a measure of identity fusion and showed that that did indeed predict endorsement of extreme behaviors.
Angel and Bill realized that as people's identities overlapped, such as with a group, an ideology, or a leader, they come to see that as an extension of themselves. They called this sense of oneness identity fusion and went on to explore what in an environment could trigger a fused identity to go further and justify violence.
The problem is that when they feel any threat, think, for example, in your family, if there is nothing happening with your family, you are not going to be aggressive or violent. But if someone tried to attack your family, you will do anything.
Is it a perceived threat or an actual threat?
Perceived threat is enough. They don't interpret this kind of behavior as violence. So something very important is that there is a moral component in violence. It is that if you think that you are defending your group, you don't think that you are being aggressive or you are being violent.
Think back a moment to the early research project, the one with children in California, which shaped thinking for decades. The problem is, by focusing so heavily on authoritarian personalities, they missed the more important conclusion. The problem was the rigid thinking, the intolerance of ambiguity, and that can come from anywhere on the political spectrum. Lior's Migrod is the researcher who revealed this and how it connects to political violence.
One of the tests that I use to measure people's cognitive rigidity or their flexibility is called the Wisconsin card sorting test. You have a kind of a set of cards in your hand and others on the screen. And what you quickly realize is that you need to match the card in your hand with one of four at the bottom of the screen. But then after a while, the rule that governs the game changes. And I'm interested in that moment of change. Because some people, when they notice that, okay, this rule doesn't work anymore, they will quickly adapt and they will now figure out a new rule and they'll continue to play the game.
Leo, though, was most interested in the people who couldn't change, people she called dogmatic.
Other people, more cognitively rigid thinkers, when they encounter that change, they hate it. They don't want the rule they've learned to change. And instead of changing their behavior, they continue to apply the old rule again and again, even though it doesn't work anymore. They actually start getting punished for following it, but they do it anyway.
In this and other experiments, Lior revealed a hallmark of identity fusion. I call it getting sucked into the whirlpool. It's the moment when dogmatic people can't update their behavior in light of new information. Instead, doubling down on a belief, even if it hurts them.
We see that people who tend to be the most rigid thinkers are the ones who are most likely to endorse violence in the name of their ideological cause. They're even going to be the ones who are most likely to be self-sacrificial in the name of their ideological mission, whatever it is, regardless of whether it's on the left or on the right.
Few of us think we're violent people, but dogmatism and identity fusion can lead to us accepting, then endorsing political violence. As the whirlpool spins faster and faster, we can all get sucked in. Even presidents of the Oxford Union and Radio 4 listeners aren't exempt. Although where we start in the whirlpool will shift based on our personality and the environment. And as we spin down, some are drawn towards the real darkness, taking violent action. So we know dogmatic brains are the most likely to be triggered and that they reframe violence as a defensive action. But what might the triggers be? Jay Van Bavel is a professor of psychology and neuroscience at New York University and the director of the Center for Conflict and Cooperation.
When people are saying things that attack our identities, our political beliefs, our nationality, our ethnicity, those are the things that make us feel defensive. And they're the types of things that make us want to react and challenge the people who are spreading this type of information about us and our groups.
This is precisely the kind of trigger, the defensive reaction Angel was talking about, which could turn into condoning and depending on the circumstances, committing violence.
Often the people who are most identified with their group, they're the most passionate about the issue, and they don't want to back down. And it actually fires them up to keep engaging.
When you say fires them up, can you talk a bit more about the neuroscience of what that involves?
Yeah, the neuroscience of getting fired up is that you feel anger. The parts of your brain that are involved in like emotional responses get activated. And those are the things that are triggering your behavior.
But Jay's research also points to what can reverse these problems, or at least hold them at bay.
One of the biggest findings about what can amplify or prevent violence is what political elites, especially political elites of a party that you trust, how they react to it. After there was an attempted assassination on Donald Trump, it was really critical at that moment for Democrats and Republicans, and I'm talking about the leaders of those parties, to come online, especially on social media, and instantly say that this is wrong, that we shouldn't be attempting to assassinate political leaders. And I saw some data that that's actually what happened after Donald Trump's attempted assassination, that violent intentions actually dropped.
My sister is a 911 dispatcher, and she reported to duty at 6 a.m. on June 14.
This is Minnesota lawyer Robin Ann Williams. Her story from 2025 illustrates the point about the importance of leadership.
And they told her that two politicians had been shot, one in Brooklyn Park. She immediately called me and told me I needed to try to call Mark and Melissa. And then she obtained another detail that made me believe that it was definitely Mark and Melissa who had been shot.
Melissa Hortman was Democrat Party leader in the Minnesota House of Representatives. Mark was her husband. And for Robin, Melissa's best friend. This is a story about the devastation this violence can cause.
Almost numb. We had been driving to hospitals to try to find them, and we drove home and got home probably about 20 minutes before the governor's press conference. And I listened to the governor say that my friends were dead, and what can he do?
The reaction to this awful event was a study of what Jay Van Bavel was saying, as leaders from different political tribes condemned what had happened.
I think for the most part, local Republicans, and I'm speaking at the local level and at the state level, I think local Republicans tried to say the right thing.
The legal case has begun, with the suspect denying murder. Meanwhile, as the state legislature opened this year, roses were laid on Melissa Hortman's desk, and the Republican leader, Melissa's former political opponent, spoke up.
We didn't always see eye to eye, but we always saw each other. And that mattered deeply, and it still does. Our strongest disagreements never turned personal because we held on to mutual respect.
So leadership matters. It sets the tone for others' responses. Be that sharply criticizing political violence, equivocating about it, or justifying it. But leadership is just one factor which makes it so hard to escape the whirlpool's pull. Back to George Aberonway.
It takes a lot of effort because I think to some degree, humility. It was quite easy to humble myself when everything is going on, but I think it took a lot to be able to take a step back, take a step outside of myself and really consider, like, why? Like, why did I react like this? Should I have reacted like this? And like really work through every single nook and cranny. And like I had many different conversations with many different people. I have a lot of different friends on varying parts of the political spectrum. So it was a lot of different conversations with people in which I'm like having to be very reflective of like my entire political perspective and going like, well, what exactly do I believe in? Why exactly am I reacting like this? Why exactly should I have or not reacted like this?
I wondered if you felt that those parts of your brain had changed or developed over the last 9 months as a result of what you've been through.
I think definitely. I've always been a very impulsive person ever since I was a child. But I think a lot of what happened, again, yeah, made me reconsider that maybe I should not always act on impulse or put up another kind of barrier that now needs to be broken down before I'm just acting on impulse. But I still, like, react, but I think now I'm able to rein that in quicker than I was before.
I asked Lior, with her expertise, what she made of this reflection.
I think his reflections remind us of our capacity to change. Sometimes we think, okay, if you've become really dogmatic or ideological about something, or you've reacted really ideologically, that's it, that's the mark of who you are. But actually, there's a lot of self-reflection that can happen, a lot of change. And so we can decide what kind of brains we want to have. And I think that's what's also being expressed here, is actually, well, maybe I want a different kind of brain, or to accentuate different aspects of my brain and my personality.
So we're all susceptible. We may look at the murders of British MPs and think, I could never condone that. My reaction would never beget further violence. The uncomfortable truth is, unless we're careful, and in polarised environments, it's even harder to be, that is increasingly likely to be exactly what happens. That's why George's story is so salutary. Once you start thinking that way, it's hard to stop. And it's why it was great to have this conversation with him. Because with conscious effort, he has. So what can each of us do about it? Well, Lior has pointed to one solution, that we can train our brains to think differently. Jay Van Bavel has suggestions too.
An important thing that individuals can do is unfollow toxic accounts on social media. And so we control our information diet in the same way that we control our diet of the food that we eat. And people understand that their diet affects their health. Well, your information diet affects the health of your brain and your belief systems.
What about the problems caused by identity fusion? Bill Swan?
I think the replacement strategy is the most promising. Getting people to fuse with something which doesn't bring them into conflict with the outgroup.
Which means emphasizing other ties. Family, friends, some other association. Defuse. But this is such a challenge. The better route is to try and prevent intense fusion in the first place. That's why being honest with yourself about your own rigidity and understanding how that might be activated is so important. Do you get triggered when you think the rules aren't fair? How often do you find a space where you form and share an identity with people you disagree with? As the pull of that whirlpool increases, the harder it is to accurately know yourself and others, and the more exhausting it becomes to pull yourself out. But in our increasingly polarizing world, with rising political violence, we all have to try.
Hello, I'm Jamie Bartlett.
And I'm Jimmy Bartlett, Jamie's AI double.
And we're here to tell you about our latest series for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Everything is fake and nobody cares. This podcast feed used to be called The Gatekeepers. That was my investigation into how Silicon Valley was taking over our information world. Now we've renamed it Everything is Fake, where you can still find that series, but also this new one with a different focus. Everyone talks about post-truth and fake news these days. I think it's missing the point.
Yeah, it's missing the point. Excellent point, Jamie.
From business to politics to media and academia, I think we now live in a world where blurring the line between reality and fantasy is not just normal, it's rewarded. And more of us just don't care.
In this series, we want to find out how that's happened.
And it's going to take us to some unexpected and very personal places. From the wrestling ring...
Look at this! He's landed! I don't believe it!
...to the world's most popular podcasters.
I feel like I was the only person in the world who had access to all this information and who saw through the bullshit, and he just got increasingly more famous.
We'll hear about dodgy academics.
It turned out, however, that all of the data in his papers were faked.
Fake essay mills.
I was writing 3, 4, 5, 6 papers a day. There was no end to the amount of work.
And COVID vaccine skeptics.
You're shaking your head.
I'm shaking
it's
my head.
It's a no-brainer. It's a no-brainer.
And together with my personalized AI assistant, we're going to figure out where this is heading as we rush headlong into a strange new world of smart machines.
We need to think of them as like alien beings, not like computer software.
Listen to Everything is Fake and Nobody Cares with me, Jamie Bartlett.
And me, Jimmy Bartlett.
First on BBC Sounds.